Psychology at Work. A podcast series exploring the work of professionals in the mental health care field, developed by the Psychology Department at Western Connecticut State University.
This is your host, Shane Murphy, and today we're interviewing Katie Fry, an assistant professor in the Psychology Department at Western Connecticut State University. She also works for Putnam Hospital, where she is on call for emergency psychiatric evaluations. And she is in graduate school, currently studying for her doctorate in clinical psychology. So thank you again, Katie, very much for taking the time to come and talk to us.
Yeah.
You know, the whole theme of these interviews in an advanced seminar in applied psychology, specializing in clinical psychology, is what people do in the mental health field. So, of course, I know you through your teaching at Western.
Yeah.
But tell us a little bit about what you do in your other
Different lives. So I teach at Western, but I also teach at Southern New Hampshire University, and I am a crisis clinician in an emergency room at Putnam Hospital. So basically what that means is I see psych patients who come into the emergency room, and then I determine their level of care, whether they're at risk to themselves or others, or if they need to go to an inpatient hospital, or if they need to go home, and kind of just set them up with a therapist. So it's very exciting work. I think it's certainly a privilege to see the patients that I do. And then on top of that, I go to school full-time, like you guys, and I don't know, 100 other things probably. But that's psych-related. I do the crisis work.
So how many hours a week would you work at Putnam?
It's on call, so it's, if I get called in, I get called in. So I teach till 8 o'clock on Wednesday nights, and then I cover the overnight at Putnam. So last night I got called in twice. So you never know. I did this work in Massachusetts before I moved, and I did it full time, and we would see 1,000 cases a month. But here in Putnam, we only see about 100 a month. So it's completely different dynamics there. So I definitely saw a lot of interesting cases in Massachusetts, but they come here and there.
What hospital were you working at in Massachusetts?
It's called Little General Hospital and Saints Hospital. It's two hospitals together, basically. But it was a mobile team, so we would go into people's homes, we would go into kids' schools, we were everywhere. So it was incredibly busy, but it was great, great work and great experience.
Was that in Boston?
No, it's in Lowell, Massachusetts, so
Lowell.
It's a city, yeah.
Yep.
North of Boston.
So that's a different experience, right? Having to go to people's homes and
yeah.
evaluate them.
Yeah.
Was that a team approach, or were you the only person doing the visits?
We would go with somebody for safety reasons, right? You always want to make sure you're safe. So we would bring somebody with us. Sometimes it was fine, no big deal. Other times you didn't want to be there. Sometimes you just had to go and lay eyes on somebody. You get a call from their case manager saying, oh, they're psychotic, they're not acting, you know, something's wrong, can you come? So we go, and sometimes they're just too distraught, too in distress, you can't see them, so you have to send them to a hospital, basically, but you have to lay eyes on them, because I can't just call and say, oh, Vladimir needs to go to the inpatient right now, he needs to go to the emergency room. No, I can't just call up and say that. I have to go and see you to make that determination, so.
Do you find, is some of it, of the work constrained by legal ramifications?
Absolutely.
I mean, as you say, like what you can and can't do in terms of like involuntary hospitalization, for example. I mean, there are a lot of laws nowadays that really sort of protect patient rights that you just can't be hospitalized, just as you say, because somebody says so.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you have HIPAA to follow, which I'm sure you've learned about. So that's always, you know, protecting confidentiality, but then I can't, again, just say I want you to go to a hospital. You do have to follow the legal ramifications. So if I was doing the mobile team and I wanted to put someone in a hospital, I would have to call the psychiatrist. And so it's called a Section 12 in Massachusetts. And basically that just means the psychiatrist says, okay, yep, sounds good. Send them to the emergency room, basically. So you're holding them against their will at that point. So, and then they have to stay in the hospital for 72 hours. So,
And then beyond that would require another evaluation, right? You can't hold a person more than 72 hours.
So then they go up to the... So if they stay in the emergency room, say we can't find placement for them, which sometimes happens. Sometimes they're so complex, even psych hospitals won't take patients, which is mind-boggling, but it happens. So they will stay in the emergency room. We have to go and see them every 24 hours and reassess their care, because sometimes people will say they're suicidal over and over and over, and then they get sick of waiting, and oh, they're finally better all of a sudden. So you have to make that determination. But sometimes once they get up to the emergency, up to the inpatient, they have to be, yeah, they have to be assessed again to really then make a treatment plan for them. So,
can you give us an example or two, perhaps, of like a sort of case that you might see in Putnam?
So last night, I can talk about the cases I had last night. I think during spring season, I see a lot of people who are bipolar and have mania is really, really big. So last night, I had a gentleman come in. He was seeing people all around his house, and that he was calling the police, and they would come. Nobody's there. They're coming. They keep coming. He keeps calling. So obviously, it's going to get to the point where the cops are not going to come anymore. So what happened last night was he then brought himself in because he thought he had CO2 poisoning since October because someone had closed the flue in the chimney. So he was convinced that he was having CO2 poisoning. And then he was convinced that people were making, you know, when you go to a hotel and you see the towels and they're made out of animals? People were taking the towels in his house and making kittens into them. So he really believed that there were these towels that were made out of kittens, and he didn't think that he was doing it, but he didn't know who did. So he wasn't exactly in the, he was delusional in a sense. He was seeing things. He should have been level of care, but he had just come in the night before and they sent him home, but he represented. So obviously he is really getting to that point where he really needs even more help. So we did put him in last night.
So he stayed overnight.
So he stayed, yeah, which he still didn't really want to, but at least he was cooperative to say, you know, whatever is good for you. And then I had a woman last week who, or maybe a better one, remember when what was that disease going on? Ebola. Yeah, I had the woman. She came in, and the police brought her in because she went to the police station saying she had the cure for Ebola. So you walk into a police station saying you have a cure, there's something going on. So they brought her into the emergency room, and she didn't want to talk to me because she thought I was Katie Couric, which I'm not. But it was a whole big thing. So she obviously had to stay and get some treatment. So there are some interesting cases.
Absolutely.
In Putnam.
And it also highlights something, you know, we talked about in class a little bit, which is like we are very familiar with schizophrenia being a syndrome where delusions and hallucinations are frequent. But during the manic phase of a bipolar disorder, that can be rather similar in terms of some of the delusions that are going on.
Absolutely.
And as with the gentleman yesterday, even hallucinations of people
being
around the house.
Yeah, and I think, you know, a big difference is when you see people who have schizophrenia and are having hallucinations, they're oftentimes paranoid, so they're really not going to tell you. But if you see someone who's more manic and bipolar, they're going to tell you every detail that they can think of, but it's very tangential or loose associations. They can't really stay on track, but they will be everywhere trying to tell you their stories. And it's a privilege. The work is really a privilege, but it's certainly a lot of work sometimes.
So let's go back, because one of the things we're fascinated in is all the training that you get and the experiences in school and out of school. What first got you interested in mental health?
Okay, so my mom was and still is a foster parent. So she took care of over 150 children in our house growing up. So at times we always had 2 to 3 kids. And she took the children in the system who suffered the most severe trauma. So they certainly needed a lot of guidance and help. And so we always had social workers, psychologists, psychiatrists coming to the house on a weekly basis. So I think I grew up with psych, and it was not a traditional household at all. It was really busy and complex. And we had children whose parents would just cause them such severe trauma. The parents would have them watch them having sexual intercourse, or have the kids watch cartoons. Those kids were watching porn. So different lifestyles. Another child who came in, my mom actually ended up adopting, had 2 broken bones, 2 broken legs, and 1 broken arm at 6 weeks old. So severe trauma, certainly. So that's probably how I got into psych, and I kind of thought that I would go and work in the FBI with it, and been an interesting course. So
where did you go to undergraduate school?
So I worked full-time and went to school full-time growing up, so I went to a college that was very convenient for me in New Hampshire, so it was Revere College at the time. So I was criminal justice major, and then I don't remember choosing psych, but I must have chosen psych and double majored at some point. And then they ended up offering a 5-year program. So I never thought I would get a graduate degree ever in my life. So I said, oh, whatever, I'll try and apply. So I got in and was one of 5 selected.
So. What was the 5-year program in?
Clinical psych.
Clinical psychology.
Yeah.
So. And then after that?
After that, I still wanted to do the FBI, so I stayed. I interviewed with the FBI, and they gave me an interview, but I was too young. So they said, come back with your MBA when you're 30. So after my master's in clinical psych, I stayed another year to get that MBA, so then I would have it ready to go back, because you can only take the test twice in your life. So that was that. And then I've tried probably 100 different careers, so don't feel like you have to get it right the first time. I've tried business, I've tried working in a hospital. You know, I love psych, but as we've talked about, getting a PhD is expensive, so I tried to just avoid that route. And I wanted to teach full-time too. I knew I loved it, I wanted to do that, but that degree is so expensive. So I tried to do anything else to make me happy, and I just wasn't happy. So I came back with open arms. Thank God.
And now you're in school taking classes again, right?
Yeah, so I gave up that fight, and I am now back in school for my PhD. So it's a circle. It really was. I had applied in 2011. I was going. I was paid my money. I was going to school. And then I just said, I already have 3 degrees. I haven't even really used them. Why am I going to now go spend another $100,000? And didn't go, which you have regrets, right? So I would have been done this year, but I'm so much more appreciative going now, because I think I really finally know what I want to do. So I'm hoping I got it.
And where are you enrolled in the PhD, and how did you choose that program?
So I chose Fielding Graduate University. It's based out of California, but it's really a different dynamic. It's you take classes sort of online, but you have a huge residency component. So I'm not just taking courses online, like if I teach at Southern New Hampshire or anything, it's Zoom. It's called Zoom, the program or GoToMeeting. You still see your teacher and you're still interacting that way. I like it. It's convenient, I guess. It still allows me to teach. At this age, I would say go to more of a traditional school, but I think at this time it works.
So interesting, isn't it? Because the technology has allowed education to change. So you have, my wife has taught at Capella University, for example, which is another big online school for many years. And it's a different model.
Yeah.
But then, as you say, you have a residency requirement. So Huge. Tell us a little bit about that. You have to go somewhere specific.
So 3 times a year I have to travel for school, so wherever they have us go, and it's, you're just taking classes, like those classes that you need. So if I'm teaching you how to do an intelligence test, I need to do that with you. I can't really do that over the computer, so we'll do things like that. And then we have to get practicums, so just like you guys get internships if you hear anything today, get an internship. I have to do that too, so I just had 5 interviews and chose one. So I'll be doing a practicum at a rehabilitation center, working with patients who have TBIs, and I'll do psych testing and cognitive behavioral therapy.
Well, where is that?
That is in White Plains.
Okay.
So it's good. It's exciting. It was more an advanced placement, but they said if you want to come and tour and see what you think about it, you can. And then luckily it worked out. So very blessed to have that coming up.
So something occurs to me I have to ask is, I know you do so many things for us, and then you're telling me about all these other things. Time management, right? How do you manage all these different balls that you're juggling at the same time?
And I do a lot with my university. I'm really huge into military psych, which we haven't even got into, so I do a lot with that too. So time management is really, I don't procrastinate. I don't put things off. They call me the firecracker at school. I don't know why. I just like to get it done. But you have to be careful with that self-care. And I can't stress that enough, is self-care. Go to the gym. Go do those things. I think that's probably my weakness, is self-care. So, but you have to do it. So time management is just, I mean, I still get 8 hours of sleep. It's just balancing it all.
It's funny because at the end of our interview on Tuesday with Dr. Nadea, we said we could have done another whole interview on balancing personal life with professional life. So
really hard.
It is, right? So maybe tell us a little bit about that, because we didn't really get a chance to talk about that on Tuesday.
Yeah, I mean, I think people need hobbies, right? I can't say that I have a lot of hobbies. But I think that I enjoy volunteering as a hobby for me. I like working with veterans. I like doing things like that. So that's probably how I spend my time. But I think the time management pieces, I think it gets a little overwhelming when you have so many things to keep track of. So I do probably 100 things, and it's would be easier if I probably did less, but I'd be bored. I prefer to be busy. So it's those things that I do aren't every single day, but it's all there to...
We've talked a little bit in previous interviews about mentors.
Mm.
How important have they been to you in your career?
So important. So important. If I stress, internships, mentors, all these things really go together. Self-care, all these things you have to do. So mentors have always been really huge in my life. I didn't really have a family who promoted education, so I went and I looked at open houses by myself in undergrad, went and looked at all these different colleges, so never really had... You know, education wasn't pushed, but mentors certainly helped bring that to a whole nother level. And I still have mentors, and my teachers from graduate program are still mentors. So stay in touch with your teachers, I think, are huge.
How do you do that?
Email. Like, I still have students, right? My original 17, I call you guys, from my first class here. Always still reach out, try to help you guys no matter what you need.
And what course was that?
Clinical psych. So my first course here, it's a nice small group, but really just always reach out, even if it's a silly thing, even just if it's, hey, I'm doing this, your teachers care, or I would imagine they care. I'd love to know what you guys end up doing. I think it's huge. So I think that's important. Also networking is huge. I went to the APA conference last year, so that was really big for me in getting a whole group of mentors to help me. I'm currently applying to the Navy, and I created this huge, or developed this team of mentors who have pushed me and made me better than I thought I could be. So when I have a break in between school, my school is trimesters. We have about 3 weeks in between. I'm not just taking a break. They're pushing me, you know, go write a story for this, go write an article, go do this. So they keep pushing you to be bigger and better than what you thought you would do. You need that push, because if not, are you gonna do it?
And it seems like you discover things about yourself that you maybe didn't even know you were capable of doing.
Yeah, and they really nurture you and help you get to that point, because there's things you probably would love to do, and you know, even colleagues, I think, are mentors. So you know, you have goals, and find those people who will help you reach them, for sure.
We haven't talked about conferences, but you mentioned APA. That's the American Psychological Association, mm-hmm. which is the biggest organization of psychologists in the USA. It goes back over 100 years.
Mm-hmm.
Was that your first APA conference?
That was my first.
Tell us your impressions, because I've been going for 30 years. But
were you there?
Yes, I was there.
Oh my goodness, I didn't know. I loved it. Seriously, you didn't think, who thought it a vacation? We said it was like our little vacation. I was like, what conference is a vacation? I had the best time. It was so much fun. And I think it's just because I just met such incredible people who had such an interest in military psych, and really, I didn't know. Like, you can go get free pictures, and oh, it was so much fun.
It was in Toronto, Canada last year, which is one of my favorite cities in the world, actually.
It's really?
Very easy city to get around. They have good public transportation.
Yeah,
it's huge though, right? Did it seem overwhelming to you with how many people are there and all the, you know, such a wide variety of areas nowadays in psychology that you could go to a workshop in clinical, or you could go to something on the neuroscience of the brain, or you could go to something on social psych?
Yeah, I think what helped the most, so I just ended up focusing on military psych there, because the advice a mentor gave me was, when you go, don't let it be overwhelming to you. Pick one thing. This year, I want to learn more about neuroscience, so you're going to go to the neuroscience talks. And I think that was helpful advice, because if you look at the book, you just don't even know where to start.
It's huge, right?
It's huge. It's huge. But there's 15,000 people, I think, that go. And, yeah, there's a lot of people, and I think it's more the building is overwhelming, trying to figure out where you're going rather than the people. But I kind of just stayed with
convention building. It can literally take you 25 minutes to get from one side to the other.
Yeah,
even ridiculous. Walking fast.
Yeah, I just stayed in the because if you go to one of the hotels, all the divisions, so in APA there's all these different divisions, so maybe you are interested in child psych, military psych, all these different divisions that you should have APA memberships if you're going to go to grad school, and then pick your division. So each division has their own suite in the hotel. So then I think I learned so much more there, I think.
Yeah, that's a good point about grad school for folks to remember if they go that route.
Yeah.
Because membership in APA for a graduate student is only $17 a year. So it's very cheap compared to what you have to pay as a professional.
Yeah.
And you just got back from EPA, right? And some of our students went there. So what did our students do at the Eastern Psychological Association meeting?
Yeah, so what we did is, there was a lot of talks about grad workshops and helping you kind of build those resumes and understand how to apply to grad schools. What I did a lot with the students was we just walked around to all the different booths and kind of learned how to ask those questions and what questions you should be asking about a graduate program. So I think I enjoyed that the most with the students.
It's almost like learning about the professional world of psychology, right? How to act, how to interact,
how to pick the right program and those questions, because they'll sell you on anything, right? They're there to sell you, so they're going to tell you anything. So it's really asking those questions you may not think of unless you've been there. So I think that's what I enjoy most in teaching is, you know, I wanted to be in the FBI. I didn't go for the right degrees. Had I known, you know, I wish someone had told me. So I think I always take that with teaching, and that's why teaching is great, but I love the mentoring aspect to it instead.
Yeah. Well, that's a good point. That's why we're doing these interviews. Mm. I want everyone in this class to know, to ask the right questions.
And I always say that about WestCon, how amazing the program is. You guys, you can go present at a conference. You can do research with faculty. I didn't have that when I went to school. I wish I did. But really, the opportunities here are outstanding. And the stats, learn your stats. If you're going to go on, learn stats. So it's great. It's really great here.
And that brings us to the final part of the interview, which is giving the class the chance to ask questions. So at this stage, I turn it over to them.
Okay.
And we'll see what questions they have.
Yeah.
Hi. So what I want to do is crisis intervention.
Oh, okay.
You work at the hospital doing that.
Mm-hmm.
How did you get involved doing that with your degree?
So basically, you need a graduate degree. You need a master's. In New York, you have to be licensed. I'm not licensed, but they let me, I guess, because I had experience. So in Massachusetts, I didn't have to be licensed, but I had the experience, and I saw so many cases in comparison to maybe what someone who is licensed on the team has seen. So it's getting that degree, and then it's, I think, getting your foot in the door is probably the most challenging.
Mm-hmm.
My situation kind of just worked out strangely. I was working in philanthropy at a hospital, and my boss knew the crisis boss, and so they told her about me and said that's really what I wanted to be doing, so she interviewed me. And I think it helped having the foster care in my life, because they wanted to make sure you're not going to fall apart when you see a client. But I also, your internships are huge, and that's how you're going to get experience. So I did the Child Advocacy Center, so children who suffered sexual abuse, we would interview them, forensic interviews, so that certainly gave me more experience as well. So I think it's getting the degree first, and then you want to make sure that you're working with diverse populations is huge.
So you mentioned licensure in New York. Do you know what would be the name of the license master's level psychologist would apply for?
Yeah, the mental health counseling, so LMHC. is one of them, and then some people have their social work degree too.
Which is what I was thinking.
Yeah. Yeah, and we've been talking a lot about that, right? The differences, and you know, I think I personally see it as different lifestyles, but I don't know if that's another question, but a whole nother topic.
Thank you. I have two, kind of just going off that for the first one. Do the licensed mental health counselors and the social workers, do they have like the same position? Can both of them are licensed? Like, can they both do the same thing with two different degrees? degrees?
Well, what I'm seeing is the difference is, yes, in my case with crisis, they can. I see a lot of social workers doing case management and things like that. In the hospital, if you just have a social work degree and you're not into crisis and you don't have that therapy background, a lot of them are doing that case management where, okay, the patient's going to go home, they need this service, and that's how I see social work. But I know that it's a big field, and you can do counseling, and you can do substance, you can do so many things as well.
You said you got your master's in clinical?
Yeah.
Would you go for something else now that you've gone through everything?
I love research, so I think my school had an experimental track and a clinical track, and I chose clinical, but I wish I had done the dissertation in my grad program, and it was optional. Had I known now, I would have done it, but I would have still gone for the same thing. But when I went, I didn't even know about the mental health counseling. No one told me. Our school even had that program, and I had no idea till I was almost done. So I got out, and I was mad at psychology, literally, in my school. I was mad at everybody because I couldn't get licensed. I didn't have enough credits, and that's still my problem. I mean, maybe now I just did a year of school. I probably have enough credits, but you still have to have that internship where you have 1,500 hours, and I wouldn't have had that because I only had to do 120. So no matter what, even after that 5-year program, I still couldn't have got licensed. So I've had friends, there were 5 of us, they all went back to get licensed mental health counseling, even though it was a program to prep us for PhD, so, if that helps at all.
There is a lot of requirements in most state regulations about how many supervised hours. The critical distinction is supervised hours. It's not just having done it,
yeah,
but you have to have like a licensed psychologist, mm-hmm, who's supervising your work and can sign off on it, right?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I know for myself, I have to have an hour for every 16 hours. I have to have an hour of supervision.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, you know my position and what I'm going for, because you helped me apply for grad school. I am going for the licensed mental health and you know, I don't know what else can I do to help me
get ready
before I go to graduate school school?
I think for you, because I know what you want to do, I know you want to build your own practice when you get out. And I think it's really connecting with the local communities and the organizations, because luckily you are a vet, but it's such a closed population. So I think it's still networking to get your foot in with those people. Not those people, but vets and those organizations. So I'm a big fan of Team RWB. They're on campus. Some of our students are vets, and they're wonderful. And the network that they provide, and they have a leadership summit. I would sign up for that even too. I think it's anything extra that you can do. And I think it's showing the Center of Deployment Psychology right now. I've gone to a few classes. They're having week-long trainings for civilians to learn about military psych and the populations and things like that. And I know that you understand a lot of the issues, but I think it would help in sense of like getting licensing and insurance, and you're gonna have to do all those insurance panels once you get licensed in a few years.
How do you find out about things that you can go to?
Oh, you email me. No. I think for me, I really, it's APA did it for me. It's the military psych. It's joining those divisions have just opened my eyes to so many things. And
no, because grad school, they have to apply to APA.
Oh, they make
mandatory.
You. That's awesome. That's a great mandatory thing. So you'll do Division 19 when you apply, and then you'll get all the emails, and you'll see those calls, and you can go and learn more about this psychologist and what they do. And I do a ton of webinars. I do tons through all these different organizations, which I'm happy to give you. But it helps you just learn more about resiliency and child abuse and all these things, these major issues that affect service members and veterans.
Division 19 is the division within APA of military psychology. So that's the name of the name of the division. Other questions?
I have one more question for you. Now that you are going for your doctorate, you like the military psych, what are you doing with it once you get your doctorate?
So currently I'm in the process of applying to the Navy, and this has been a year-long process in the hopes to become a naval psychologist. So I'm applying for a scholarship that they only choose 5 people in the country, so can only hope. But my goal is to be a naval psychologist. Like I said, I think I finally figured it out. It took a very long time, but I think I'm there. So really my life is sort of has become built around that. So I chose neuropsych as my concentration, which is not going to be easy for me at all. Like you're talking about anatomy and all that stuff. Oh, it's going to be so hard. But that's what's going to benefit me in the long run. And they want cognitive behavioral therapy, you know, evidence-based practices. So I'm choosing that as well. So hopefully it will happen. But if it doesn't happen, just keep trying. So.
So it's plan B and then C, right?
Yeah, I haven't got my mind around that yet.
All right, well, let's thank Katie Fry very much.
Thank you.